Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with veteran New York Times foreign correspondent Chris Hedges, who was suing President Obama in federal court, challenging his powers under the National Defense Authorization Act. In advance of the president's 2013 State of the Union address, we will discuss what Chris Hedges expects from the address and why he feels America is becoming a corporate state that is seizing unchecked powers with a military system of justice that will criminalize dissent. Then we'll hear from Adele Stan, Alternet's Washington bureau chief, who has followed the Tea Party since its inception. We'll discuss the two successive Republican responses to Obama's State of the Union from two Tea Party senators, Marco Rubio and Rand Paul. We'll also look into whether the president will put the Republicans on notice as they are poised to let the sequester crash the barely recovering economy, thus throwing us back into recession and impoverishing millions of Americans. Then we look into whether the president has taken on too many challenges in his second term with gun control, immigration, global warming, jobs, and economic recovery. Mike Lux, the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, joins us to discuss what the president might be able to accomplish in his second term before the next midterm election and whether the Democrats could retake the House in 2014 and extend Obama's ability to govern before he becomes a lame duck. Then finally, we'll be joined by Tara McGinnis, the Executive Director of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. We'll assess the likely impact of the president's address on the public and, more importantly, the Congress that remains implacably hostile to Obama's efforts to revive the economy and appoint his choices to his cabinet and fill the growing backlog of judicial appointments. Chris Hedges is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times, where in 2002 he was part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He was also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights and is the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class, and his latest, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He has an article at truthdig.com, the NDAA and the Death of the Democratic State. Welcome, Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
And your sense of the State of the Union, I take it, will be quite different from what the president will deliver in an hour's time or less than an hour, where I take it, since you are suing the president in Hedges versus Obama in federal court, and it's likely to end up at the Supreme Court, I take it your sense is that the corporate state has handed the president tools to use deadly force and military power to criminalize dissent. I imagine that is not the message we'll hear tonight.
No, I mean, the Obama administration has in essence codified the destruction of both domestic and international law. And I would remind listeners that preemptive war under international law is illegal. It's defined as a criminal war of aggression. The assault on civil liberties under the Obama administration is more egregious than it has been or was under the Bush administration. The radical interpretation of the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act as giving the executive branch the right to assassinate American citizens, the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping of tens of millions of American citizens. And we know that our personal information is being stored in perpetuity in supercomputers in Utah. The use of the Espionage Act six times by the Obama administration to go after whistleblowers, the Espionage Act being our Foreign Secret Act, was not designed to shut down people who exposed government crimes, malfeasance, and lies, but that is how Obama has used it. Kiriakou, the CIA operative who purportedly gave information about war crimes to the New York Times, has just started a 30-month prison sentence. And then, as you mentioned, the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021, I sued the president last January in the Southern District Court of New York over this section of the NDAA, which permits the U.S. military, this is contravening 200 years of domestic law, to seize American citizens, strip them of due process, and hold them indefinitely in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies. Now, we won that case. In September, Judge Catherine Forrest ruled in our favor. The response of the Obama administration was chilling. We knew they'd appeal. That wasn't a question. But they didn't just appeal. The ruling was made on a Friday. The government lawyers went to Judge Forrest and asked for a temporary stay of the injunction, meaning the law would be put back into effect until the appeal could be heard by the Second Circuit. Judge Forrest refused. The government attorneys then went to the Second Circuit. This was late on a Friday, and asked for an emergency hearing at 9 a.m. on Monday morning. They got it. The Second Circuit lifted the injunction, put the law back into effect, and that was a message both to myself and to the lawyers, Carl Mayer and Bruce Afron, who brought the case, that there's a very high likelihood that the law is already being used, probably to detain U.S. dual nationals, Pakistan U.S. nationals, in places like Bagram. Because if the injunction had been allowed to stand and the government was holding U.S. citizens and denying them due process, then of course they would be in contempt of court. So I have not found the rhetoric of Barack Obama or the Obama administration to match, in any way match the activities of the Obama administration, which, whether it's, a failure to rein in the malfeasance and criminal activity and fraud of Wall Street, the assault, the expansion of drilling, of course, the Obama administration has approved the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline and looks set now to approve the northern leg. It is a kind of utter disconnect between how this president and his administration presents himself and his policies to the American people and what he actually does.
It does seem, though, that he's driving his Republican opponents, particularly the guy that he beat in the 2008 election, who seems to be a real sore loser, John McCain, and, of course, Lindsey Graham, who's the architect of the NDAA, at least its primary sponsor, is doing everything he can to frustrate him. So it would seem that at least Obama has got the United States out of two wars, where McCain and Lindsey Graham, if McCain had been elected, he would have got us into two more, Syria and Iran. So do you see a difference there?
Well, first of all, in terms of the NDAA, this has bipartisan support. The bill was sponsored by McCain in 11, there's no daylight between the Republicans and the Democrats on this issue. Which is why you never hear about it on these partisan channels like Fox or MSNBC. In terms of going to war with Iran, the establishment, and in particular the Pentagon, wants nothing to do with it. If you remember, after Barack Obama was elected in November of 2008, there was a heavy push by Israel to get the Bush administration to strike against Iran, and they refused. In terms of intervening in Syria, I don't think that there's anybody within the established centers of power, both in the intelligence community and the Pentagon, that wants to start wading into Syria. Unlike Libya, it doesn't have oil. So I'm not completely convinced that a McCain administration would have started a war with either Iran or Syria. John McCain, unlike Newt Gingrich, is sane. What is frightening, of course, is that lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, because they're just completely unhinged, and they did a lot, of course, to elect Barack Obama, or contribute to the election of Barack Obama.
Well, at this point, they appear to be quite prepared to impoverish millions of their fellow Americans by creating a new recession, by forcing through these sequester cuts. And Economics 101 tells you that when you're in an economic recovery, the last thing you need is austerity. So what explains that? Is that ideology or ignorance, or do they have some other agenda?
Well, they serve, they cravenly serve corporate interests. There's a business term, it's called harvesting, where you take over a corporation and cannibalize it and destroy it and extract the last vestiges of profit from it on the way down. Well, that's basically what the corporate state is doing to the nation writ large. Barack Obama has offered, at best, very tepid opposition to this. You know, as Paul Krugman writes week after week, what we really needed is, of course, a massive jobs program, especially targeted to people under the age of 25, a rational health care system. Obamacare was written by corporate lobbyists, $447 billion in subsidies to the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, in essence the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for those industries, and copayments and premiums can skyrocket, especially if you're ill. The failure to confront the housing crisis, the foreclosures and the bank repossessions, the failure to rein in Wall Street, which is well on its way towards inflating the economy towards another crash, borrowing money at basically 0% interest and then letting it back to us at usury rates, if you're late on your credit card, of close to 30%. I'm not sure what that is. It's certainly not capitalism. So I don't see that Barack Obama, in terms of his policies, has done anything to stand up for working men and women, and in fact has aided and abetted this corporate assault.
Well, just in closing, Chris Hedges, the president has tonight apparently an elderly Haitian-American woman who stood 6 hours in line joining, or at least the First Lady, she's joining her party at the State of the Union. And that leads us to the question of voter suppression. And, of course, both parties have gerrymandered enormously. Lately, the Republicans seem to have an advantage in gerrymandering, and they've already sort of even floated the idea of changing the Electoral College in order to overcome their demographic problems. They basically have a plan to cheat. So if we do have a corporate state and a kind of game show democracy, it would seem that at least there is a difference between the two parties. One wants people to vote and the other one doesn't want people to vote, particularly what...
Well, the Democratic Party understands that, if you're part of the poor or the working class, you usually don't have anywhere else to go. That's not always true, of course, in the South. So this is a jockeying for, pieces of the prize. But I'm not sure that at this point there are significant differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, the Democratic Party in Europe, where I used to live, would be considered a far-right party. It embraces torture. It calls for the expansion of imperial wars. It draws up kill lists. These are just absolutely staggering things to embrace. It's utterly failed to stand up to Wall Street. The suffering, and this is something that Joe Sacco and I spent the last 2 years chronicling in our sacrifice zones, these pockets of misery that have been rendered courtesy of a corporate media virtually invisible, has turned whole pockets of the United States into, in essence, a third world country. So I'm not saying that there aren't differences between Obama and McCain. There are. I'm not saying that there are not differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. There are. I certainly find Obama as a personally more palatable than a figure like Romney. And yet I think that the people who have their hands on the levers of power do not significantly change from one administration to the next.
So given the president is somewhat spreading himself thin, the gun control issue was foisted on him by the massacre. He also wants to deal with immigration and gay rights, etc. What about global warming? Not to be too apocalyptic, but frankly, the planet is endangered and ignorance is preventing us in this country from grasping the looming reality, even though nature is telling us with these superstorms. Do you expect anything on that front?
No, and, whether it's Kyoto or Durban or Copenhagen during the Obama administration, Obama and his administration virtually wash their hands of it because they don't want to take on the fossil fuel industry. And you're right. The most dire predictions of climate scientists of even a few years ago now look modest and restrained, given that 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melted. And what is the response of the corporate state? Well, Shell Oil is up there dropping $500 million bids. to extract profit from the death throes of the planet. Another, we just on the East Coast lived through Hurricane Sandy, over $70 billion worth of damage. Well, wait till the next hurricane season rolls around and it's a Category 2 instead of a Category 1. Wait till we hit, that these infrastructures can't sustain that kind of damage and finally continually be rebuilt. I think that we're in extremely serious trouble in terms of the ecosystem and the Obama administration. This will, whoever writes history in the future, I think will look back and consider this the greatest failing of the Obama administration, not to stand up and radically reconfigure our relationship to each other and to the ecosystem to provide a sustainable world for future generations.
Well, Chris Hedges, I thank you so much for joining us here on the eve of President Obama's State of the Union Address.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Hedges, who's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times, where in 2002 he's part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights and is the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class, and his latest Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He has an article at truthdig.com, The NDAA and the Death of the Democratic State. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back joined by Adele Stan, Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief.
What's my name? What's my station? Just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. Joining us now is Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She co-edited with Don Hazen the Alternet book Dangerous Brew, Exposing the Tea Party's Agenda to Take Over America. Welcome, Adele Stan.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And obviously, you've covered the Tea Party over its various iterations as a supposed grassroots organization that sprung out of the outrage over the bailout for the 2008 crash of Wall Street. And has now become clearly a astroturf operation and financed by a handful of bilious billionaires, and they faithfully execute the agenda of the super rich. But what I find extraordinary about the rebuttal to the president's State of the Union tonight is that the two Tea Party spokespeople are on, Marco Rubio, who is the protege of Jim DeMint, and who's about as dyed-in-the-wool Tea Party person as you can get, along with Rand Paul, who is ostensibly the Tea Party guy. So what kind of kabuki theater are the Republicans playing here?
Well, this is so extraordinary, Ian. You're absolutely correct. I mean, I watched Marco Rubio's, one might call it his big coming out speech in the debutante sense to the National Conservative Movement at the Conservative Political Action Conference several years ago. And indeed, he is sort of the great hope of the right wing of the party, and is very much allied, as you said, with the Tea Party movement. In fact, his nomination to the to the Senate seat he now has was through a primary challenge to the sitting governor, Charlie Crist, who is what would be considered a more, at least at the time, an establishment Republican. However, What we see happening now is in tapping Marco Rubio, Rubio now runs the risk of being the establishment Republican because he was tapped to deliver this response to the president's State of the Union message. And that has to do with the drubbing that Republicans took, significantly at the hands of Latino voters. And Rubio is a guy who has always had a somewhat softer position on immigration policy than the party at large, and particularly the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. So that is his why he is out there, why they are putting him out there. But, you know, the Tea Party has been doing these rebuttals to both the establishment Republican Party and the president's State of the Union message now for the past couple of years. And when we say the Tea Party, Ian, that's probably too general a term. It's being done by a group called the Tea Party Express. And the Tea Party Express are not simply an AstroTurf group, but they are as a PAC, a political action committee of old hands at right-wing Republican fundraising. So that is what we have there. And both, and Rand Paul, of course, was a protege of Jim DeMint as well.
So what do you expect from tonight, Adele Stan, in terms of the president, who appears to be spreading himself thin in his second term? And unless the Democrats are able to turn things around in 2014, right, the clock is ticking on him being a lame duck. So the window is closing, and he's, of course, gun control has been forced on him by what happened in Connecticut. Global warming ought to be hitting him in the face because of the superstorm, one of many, and they're going to increase in frequency and in strength as global warming becomes more and more manifest. Immigration, as you mentioned, with the Republicans putting up their kinder and gentler face in the form of Marco Rubio, gay rights, etc. So normally presidents figure out what they can do in their second term and choose rather narrowly. It seems that the president has got a broad menu here. What do you think he's going to get done?
What I think he has a good shot at getting immigration done in some form because of how the Republicans suffered in the last election. I think that that's something he has a real shot at. I think that the other issues, well, gun control, he'll probably get some form of perhaps ammunition, the a ban on large magazines, and he'll probably get the background check. Perhaps, I shouldn't even say probably, Ian, because it's got to get through the House, and
The House have invited, at least one House member has invited Ted Nugent into the chamber.
Which is extraordinary.
Well, this has been a pattern, hasn't it, since Obama's become president, that angry white men are able to express their venom without sanction.
Indeed. I mean, from the very first, before he even did his State of the Union, because the president's first speech in office is really a speech before the joint, joint session of Congress. It's not quite a State of the Union, but that's the speech at which, you know, Joe Wilson screamed, "You lie." Here we have Ted Nugent, who, entertains wearing a Confederate flag, who has performed with machine guns and saying that the president should suck on his. He's used all kinds of language about the president and Hillary Clinton that we cannot use on the radio, and this is whom Steve Stockton tends, he decides to bring to the State of the Union, and the very same State of the Union that the First Lady will have in her box, the parents of a slain child, Hadia Pendleton, who was killed sitting in a park in Chicago, and who had performed in the inauguration parade with her high school's majorette group. And apparently somebody from Newtown, Connecticut, I don't know if it's the parents of one of the slain children or whatever. So, I mean, this is just, it's just beyond imagination, you know. It's not even something I could imagine happening, 40 years ago, even though the country was in such a racial strife at that time. You wouldn't have had something like this going on in the Congress. It's just really crazy.
So Adele Stan, again, Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief, do you think that the president, who's not normally confrontational, and apparently the preview of the speech indicates that he's going to make nice and try and reach over and get something done and use that dreadful word compromise. But on the other hand, given that the Republicans are determined to tank the economy and create another recession, because they're going to go ahead and push this sequester, which will take an enormous amount of money out of the economy, struggling to revive. This is economics 101. We know that what austerity does. We've seen it, what it's done in Europe, and it will do the same thing here. So in other words, the Republicans are deliberately inflicting a lot of pain, cruel and unusual punishment on the American people, impoverishing millions of their fellow Americans.
Right.
For no reason whatsoever, except perhaps their own ideology or their fealty towards billionaires who want to turn America into a plantation economy. So don't you think he should step up and lay this marker down and put the American people on notice that these crazies are about to do this?
Yes, I do. And I'm not yet, I think we'll see what's in between the tea leaves that we're reading. I do still expect the more pugilistic Obama 2.0 that we have seen since his first press conference following the election. I do expect that Obama to be at the podium tonight far more than the previous conciliatory Obama. I mean, I think he will likely pay some lip service to bipartisanship, but I think that he will continue with marking out the more progressive agenda that so vexed the Republicans after his inauguration. So I'm not yet ready to concede that the president is going to roll over. I do still have concerns about what he might be willing to compromise vis-a-vis Social Security, this whole notion of the chain CPI, which is really a reduction in benefits, troubles me. But I think we shall see.
So what explains Lindsey Graham's hissy fits against the president? We understand John McCain's bitterness about losing, and he'll do anything he can to sabotage the president and undermine his authority. And these two guys have tag-teamed him on. They're going to try and block the nominations of Chuck Hagel at Defense and John Brennan at the CIA. And I suspect, this at least my theory is, that one of the reasons they're so mad at Obama is that Obama has been out-hawking the Republicans on national security. Normally, the Democrats are defensive on national security and the Republicans own it. And now Obama is so hawkish on defense.
Especially with the drone program.
That they got nowhere to go. Is that what their frustration's about?
I think that's part of it. And I do feel that even as they respond so cantankerously to the Hagel nomination, they know that they are somehow fulfilling the president's game plan for their own behavior, and that makes them even crazier. I mean, I do think that Obama gamed this, you know, nominating Hagel because he was indeed a Republican, and that would give the country a show of just how unwilling to compromise at all that they are, that they would go after one of their own this way because simply because the president nominated him. However, I do think there's another bit of politics in play vis-a-vis Lindsey Graham, and that is that he is up for re-election, Ian, and he will face a primary challenge from the right. If he does not, you know, play a very, very hard game and make a big show of attacking the president, the Tea Party does not love, the Tea Party folks do not love Lindsey Graham. So he is really trying to show his stuff.
Well, but what explains the apparent inexorable ability of right-wing Americans to pull America's political discourse further and further to the right? The Tea Party have done that. They're just really the repackaging of the Republican right under a different label.
Surely.
And they have managed to capture the Republican Party and move the discourse way to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious to know why in this country you cannot have a left-wing equivalent of the Tea Party that moves the country to the left, or at least tries to balance up the tug of gravity here.
Well, I think that it has to do, Ian, with sort of the difference in structure between the left and the right. And the left has always been far more prey to balkanization or long issue lines, where the right tends to be more of a cultural identity movement. You know, the left is a coalition of very many different kinds of people, people from all sorts of different ethnic, racial, class backgrounds. The right tends to be a movement of white people, who, and a particular type of white person who is very fearful of change. So you have, just structurally, I think you have the left at a disadvantage. Then when you factor in the way the two different movements are funded, you know, first of all, you know, rich people who want to fund the left are basically betting against their own economic interests, A. And B, the left-wing funders tend to fund in the same way that the movement is structured, which is by project, by project, by project, by issue, instead of giving, you know, left-wing organizations operating budgets to work with. The right has never had that problem. They are very happy to fund the operating budgets of right-wing organizations and think tanks. So I do think a lot of the problem is structural.
So does that mean the president in this State of the Union is supposed to mention the growing disparity of wealth and how to address it? I know he's going to talk about jobs,
right,
and jobs, but it would seem to me that if money is the new currency of politics, it therefore means that the person with money wins, the person without money doesn't. So if our politics have become about money primarily and less about issues and candidates, isn't that a good place to start? I mean, after all, the Occupy movement framed this debate in the 99% versus
right,
one. So if you remember the 99%, it seems less important what your ethnicity is and what your sexual preferences are. It seems more important to form some kind of solidarity with your brothers and sisters before the billionaires take over the whole ballgame.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it is happening. I think it's a very hard thing to make happen very quickly. I mean, I really do believe that that is indeed happening, and I also think we have a younger generation of activists that, you know, that do not carry the baggage that those of us who are, you know, came of age, you know, as baby boomers have along those lines. However, I think that it's just, if left to proceed organically, it's going to be too slow a process. You know, it needs to be jump started. I think that it needs a little help. You know, from it needs an infusion of cash as much as it needs an infusion of energy.
Well, just in closing, Adele Stan, again, Alternet's Washington bureau chief. What's your expectation tonight? Better question: what's your wish that he will say and that will resonate?
Well, I really hope, Ian, that on this notion of these automatic spending cuts that the Republicans are insisting must take place, you know, that they refuse to take any action to stop, I hope that he truly lays that at the feet of the Republicans and lays out the kind of argument that you've been making, that they, I mean, Eric Cantor himself said we're going to hurt a lot of people. Eric Cantor is, of course, the House majority.
He's also said it's Obama's sequester, and
yes,
so is Mitch McConnell. I mean, these people are unbelievable liars.
They're absolutely unbelievable. So I hope that Obama can find a way to lay that at their feet and to also mention that they're talking about wanting to shut down the government. I hope that he does that. Overall, I wish that I could expect him to say that we're going to end the use of drones, you know, to assassinate American citizens or to deliver lessons to civilian areas in Pakistan, but I don't expect that, unfortunately. But I do think that the biggest thing that he can do is to say, you know, come on, America, we need to come together to save this country, to save our economy, to create jobs, and I want you to look at those guys across the aisle, because they're the ones who are standing in our way. Now, you know, I mean, he can't say it quite that way, but he may come close.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Adele Stan.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She co-edited with Don Hazen the Alternet book, Dangerous Brew, Exposing the Tea Party's Agenda to Take Over America. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about whether the president has taken on too many challenges in his second term.
Bruce Rosner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. Joining us now is Mike Lux, who's a partner at Democracy Partners. He's also the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995. And he's the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Mike, what do you expect the president to say today in terms of laying out a progressive agenda? My understanding is he's going to try and make nice to the Republicans in the hope that they can get something done. And I'm wondering whether making nice to people who are about to tank the economy and create a new recession is necessarily a useful exercise.
Well, I'm not clear that he's going to make nice. You know, it'll be fascinating to see what he decides to do. And I have not seen any advance copies of the speech. What I've been told by White House officials is that there'll be a heavy focus on the economy, on strengthening and rebuilding the middle class. They'll talk about immigration reform. They'll talk about guns. They'll talk about, you know, you use the president's formulation of a balanced approach in terms of the budget, you know, combination of taxes and budget cuts. So I think he's going to stick pretty heavily to the themes that he's been sticking to for the last year. And I don't know that translates into being nice to the Republicans. I have no doubt that he will, like all presidents, he will make rhetorical gestures of outreach, say, talk about how much he wants to work with them, how much he values their ideas, how he's willing to look at any idea that gets him to his goals, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't expect that this will be a speech that will make an old progressive like myself cringe in terms of its, you know, reaching out in uncomfortable ways to Republicans.
But if they are determined to go ahead with sequester, which, by the way, Eric Cantor and Mitch McConnell refer to as the Obama sequester, even though all the Republicans just about and only a few Democrats actually voted for it, and it was something that came out of the Republican House. So they seem determined, and we just know from Economics 101 that if you take out billions of dollars out of an economy that's struggling to recover, you will create another recession and millions of Americans will be impoverished. And what's the point? I mean, isn't that a reckless endangerment of the American people?
Yes, it is. No question about it. And I hope that the Republicans will be called to task for this. I know that the president is going to talk very forcefully about how, you know, they need to do a balanced deal rather than doing the sequester. So I don't think there's any question that that will come up. State of the Unions aren't traditionally, you don't tend to have traditionally the most pointed partisan rhetoric. So I don't know how much he's going to directly bang on them over that. But I think he will be, and hope he'll be pretty forceful in saying why he disagrees with what they're doing.
Well, it seems that with John McCain constantly trying to undermine him and Lindsey Graham on this kind of jihad against both him and Hillary Clinton over this trumped-up Benghazi story, that you would think that the president would at least have to address the North Korean nuclear test. Do you think that a part of Lindsey Graham and John McCain's petulance and anger towards the president is the fact that he's taken away national security from the Republicans, that he's out-hawked them?
Well, of course. I mean, these guys are seeing their neocon dreams go up in smoke because the president, you know, has been aggressive on foreign policy. In my opinion, he's been too aggressive at times. I think this drone stuff without judicial review is actually pretty awful. But clearly, the president has completely undercut people like McCain and Lindsey Graham with their neocon dreams, and he's put them in a position where they don't really have much credibility anymore on those issues. So they're going to object to everything he does and everything he says in that regard.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Glucks, a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to President Clinton for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995 and is the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. What's your sense then of the president's priorities, particularly given that he's been forced, in effect, into taking up gun control, which the Democrats have shied away from? He has to talk about global warming because we've had these repetitive superstorms that are going to become both more powerful and more frequent as global warming becomes real. He's also got the deal with gay rights and immigration. This starting to look like a pretty ambitious agenda, and unless the Democrats somehow turn things around in 2014, and it doesn't happen as normally when in the midterms, the party that owns the White House gets a drubbing. If that happens, then he's a lame duck a lot quicker than he would normally be. So two questions, really. Can the Democrats change things in 2014 so that they can actually get something done with this second term? And two, has the president spread himself too thin?
Well, there's a lot of questions and a lot of subtopics within those questions. First of all, on the spreading too thin, you don't have any choice when you're president, in my opinion. I worked in the Bill Clinton White House. We went in saying that we were going to focus like a laser beam on the economy, and we did focus a lot on the economy. Most of our first year was spent getting an economic package passed with not a single Republican vote that really did help improve the economy dramatically over the next 8 years. We created 23 million jobs went from a deep budget deficit to a budget surplus because the economy was so strong. Not, by the way, mostly because of budget cuts, but because the economy was so strong. That's how you create surpluses. But we still had other issues we had to deal with. Presidents have to deal with a world of issues. It's the nature of the presidency. You have things come up that don't expect. You have issues raise their head that you don't expect. And it would be wrong as a president not to deal with important things. I would also add that on an issue like immigration, for example, I think immigration is tied very closely to the economy. The fact that we've got this whole class of of folks who are treated terribly, who are exploited by employers, who get terrible wages because they don't have documentation papers, and there's no path to getting them right now. that affects the entire economy. And there's been all kinds of research that shows that if you get immigration done, you can do something to help the economy. You talk about being spread thin, but there are things like that. I would add implementing the Health Care Act that was passed in the first term, Obamacare. You get things like that done, it does help the economy, which helps on jobs, which helps on the federal budget deficit. A lot of these things are interrelated. I guess that's how I would respond to the spreading too thin. You have to do multiple things when you're president. You have to be able to walk, chew gum, and do all kinds of other things at the same time. There's no choice in the matter. Secondly, I would say that we do have a good chance in 2014. I've seen some polls recently that show that the Republicans in Congress have the single worst brand of any political entity, any political institution in the entire country. On the generic poll in terms of members of Congress, where the latest polls I've seen show us leading by 8 points. We won by 2 in the last election, and we picked up 8 seats. So I also remember in 2006 when everybody said there was no chance whatsoever because of redistricting that the Democrats would take back the House. Turns out we picked up 31 seats, took back the House easily, and added another 20 seats in the next election. So these kinds of elections, you don't know what's going to happen. In 1998, it was the sixth year of Clinton's term. Everybody said we would lose a lot of seats. The Lewinsky affair happened. Everybody said we were going to lose more. We ended up picking up 5 seats. I'm actually quite optimistic in our ability to get that done. And I think you had some other things I wanted to respond to in those questions okay. as well. But
I was just going to add to that your old boss Bill Clinton just gave the House Democrats a pep talk recently, just last Friday, in fact, and he told them to own health care, that they should be proud of Obamacare, which I've never understood why Obama has not been full throated in his support of his own major achievement. But just in closing, Mike Lux, the Republicans are putting up a couple of Tea Party candidates. Rubio, who's died in the wool Tea Party, a protege of Jim DeMint, even though our press is talking about him now as the kinder and gentler face of the Republican Party. I think they're completely off the mark there. And then, of course, you've got the other Tea Party zealot, Rand Paul, as well, giving addresses. Is this going to further have them relegate themselves to loony land?
I think so. You know, the Republicans, they really don't have a choice in terms of putting up these far, far right-wing folks because their primary voters, their base, absolutely demands it. They would go wild if they actually had a moderate Republican speak on an issue or give the response to the president. So they're locked in, and so they can't move on the issues, and their entire strategy has been, let's see if we can't figure out how to soften it rhetorically maybe a little bit. But they're locked in an issue box that is so extreme that it's going to be very, very hard for them to get out of it. So they're going to keep putting up people like Rubio and Rand Paul, who are, you know, crazy folks. There's no doubt about it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on the, just in advance of the President's State of the Union address, Mike Lux.
Very happy to do it, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lux, who's a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to President Clinton for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995, and he's the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And joining us now is Tara McGinnis, who is Executive Director of the Center for American Progress Action Fund and Senior Vice President for Communications at the Center for American Progress. Previously, she directed the Progressive Accountability Project during the 2008 presidential campaign and was Deputy Director of Americans Against Escalation in Iraq. A veteran of House, Senate, and Issues campaigns, she also served in the United States House of Representatives for Representative Edward Markey and as a press secretary on John Kerry's presidential campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tara McGinnis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And what do you expect to hear from the president in about 15 minutes or so from now, Tara? Is he going to revisit the theme of economic justice and fairness in this country, do you think?
I think he is. I think early signs are that he's largely going to focus on picking up where he left off in the inauguration speech, the inaugural address, focusing on the long-term things that it takes to get the country moving and growing, and really focusing in on what it means for an economy that works for all Americans, not just those who've been doing really well.
Well, in his inauguration, he did mention global warming, which did not come up in the presidential campaign to the chagrin of a lot of people. So one would expect maybe he will also mention that, particularly given the recent storms, Sandy and then just Nemo. Do you think that we'll get something along the lines of what that problem or that incredible challenge to the planet poses, which is really a kind of Manhattan project or Jack Kennedy's invocation to put a man on the moon and bring him back?
I think certainly he's going to talk about climate change tonight. I think because it's impacting communities across the country in such a real way, this is an opportunity for the president to speak directly to the public, not only about how he's going to address climate change, but really using the bully pulpit to put front and center this being one of the issues of our time. You know, there's a number of proposals on the table how he could use the powers he has as president through either executive orders or working with the cabinet to increase the planning that's happening on climate change. He could also talk more about regulations or investments as he has in his previous State of the Union addresses on clean energy, getting us onto cleaner, more renewable, less carbon through our national energy program.
So there is a bit of a disconnect here, isn't there, Tara McGinnis? Again, the Executive Director of the Center for American Progress's Action Fund and a Senior Vice President for Communications at the Center for American Progress. The sense is that no matter how lofty the rhetoric is, the reality is that you've got a Congress that's implacably hostile, a House of Representatives that's implacably hostile to the president. And they are poised to basically tank the economy if they go ahead with this sequester, which will bring about a new recession and stop the recovery and unnecessarily punish millions of Americans and impoverish them.
You know, I think you raise a really interesting point. And the State of the Union gives the president a moment, you know, a rare moment to speak directly to the American public, to tens of millions of viewers, but to Congress, you know, standing in front of Congress. The question of what he's for and then the, you know, what happens once, Congress is engaged and what really makes it through the mix in terms of taking action on the economy, as you mentioned, sequestration, whether it's climate change, or getting some of the other issues he's talked about before that I think will be raised tonight, addressing gun violence or immigration, much of this goes through the crucible of Congress. And so I think for those, including whether it's Marco Rubio or there are, you know, several different Republicans who are giving responses. I don't think there is a Republican response. You've got at least two people giving in Senator Paul.
Rand Paul.
Paul, yeah. Rather, giving the second address, that there's real risk for stepping between a very popular president with what I would argue is, much public support in blocking some of these things. And so I think it's a high-risk venture for Republicans in particular to get between the president and a popular agenda, and we'll see whether that's what they decide to do this evening.
Well, it's worth noting, Tara McGuinness, that Marco Rubio, who is as much of a Tea Party candidate as Rand Paul, so it's kind of somewhat redundant, these two,
yes,
rebuttals. But Marco Rubio just recently reiterated his stance against global warming. He doesn't believe it's real. So
one can only hope he
brings it up, right? I mean,
yeah,
we might as well, they might as well be straightforward about their positions, even if they don't make any sense in the real world.
I think it's really, I think it's telling that they haven't, that they couldn't even create one cohesive response, that in fact, Marco Rubio, as you pointed out, was the Tea Party candidate running against an establishment Republican candidate when he first ran, is being bested by another Tea Party response, that Marco Rubio wasn't even trusted by the Tea Party. That this sort of shows, I think, a disarray in terms of the future of the Republican Party. But frankly, I don't think cosmetic rebranding is good listening on behalf of Republicans for what sort of real serious soul searching needs to come about. In fact, I think if Marco Rubio continues to kind of talk about the importance of immigration while fighting the process of a comprehensive immigration bill, or talk about the importance of women in the Republican Party while fighting very common sense measures to protect men and women from domestic violence, that this kind of glossing over and rebranding isn't going to get very far.
So at the moment, of course, the big fight is over the president getting not just the economy, continuing the recovery, which is now endangered by the sequester, but also getting his cabinet appointees seated and confirmed,
yeah,
with particularly the one of the more important ones being Secretary of Defense, and then the head of the CIA. And there's this kind of jihad from the guy that lost in 2008, John McCain, and his sidekick, Lindsey Graham. I was talking earlier to a couple of the guests, suggesting that in many ways, I think it is explained by the frustration and anger that McCain and other Republicans have, that Obama has sort of, taken back national security, which normally the Democrats have been defensive on, and the Republicans have owned that. Do you have an explanation for this continuing guerrilla war that John McCain, the sore loser, is engaged in?
I don't really have an explanation for John McCain. He's been, throughout his record in the Senate, known to take on some of these fights in quite a personal fashion. But I'd make an observation about the larger role of Republicans in blocking not only nominations to the cabinet, but in many cases to the second tier of people, the COOs, the people who are running various government agencies, and in terms of blocking judges. The Republicans did a tremendous job at stalling all levels of appointments of judges for the Obama administration. And frankly, if you don't believe in the role that a government can play in the country, that if ideologically, like many conservatives, you want to whittle away the government to the point where you could drown in the bathtub, that this is a very effective way to throw mud and cog in the wheels of making it function, right? To have the people who make daily decisions to have shortages of judges so that courts aren't seeing people. So that, John McCain, and I think this is quite personal in his fight, but I think, frankly, perhaps what's even more pervasive and destructive is the slowing down of appointing people to all levels of government to the point where you're actually helping in creating dysfunction.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.